Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Bunker Daily, the little heirloom cherry tomato sibling to Wednesday's hormone-boosted beefsteak podcast. I am your host, Alex Andreu. A few centuries ago, today's guest would have found himself on a ducking stool for being obviously possessed and speaking in tongues, but standards in this country have slipped since then, and he finds himself instead the country's most celebrated impressionist. Welcome, Rory Bremner.
Hi, Alex. Lovely to speak to you. What an introduction. That's the most erudite by far.
How are you, darling man?
I'm fine. I'm very, very well. Very lucky. We're kind of out in the country and have been spared, except for a lovely Tim Brooke Taylor, who we lost in the April weekend, was our coronavirus victim. We toured in January. And so that was the closest and the most tragic that it got. We've, by contrast, we've been pretty lucky. And it's just going on forever and ever, isn't it? It's
I think we just have to learn to live with it now.
We do. Well, my daughter, she does a lot of, she does some international riding and these horse events. There was an organizer, you may have remembered 2 years ago, the Liverpool Horse Show was sort of terminated when the car park caught fire. There was a massive fire in the car park and they had to evacuate everybody and the horses. And then last year, it was flooded out because they had torrential rain and they had to cancel the thing because of floods. And so we said, well, you've had the fire, you've had the floods. It'll be the plague next. And, I mean, what are the chances, you know? I mean, but it is. We seem to be racking up these once-in-a-thousand-year events or indeed once-in-a-hundred-year events. They seem to be coming more rapidly, you know, bank crashes and, you know, and plagues and things. But it is, it's all part of the box set life that we're leading at the moment where you think, who is writing this? And they're ramping it up. I mean, when Boris went into intensive care, you thought they have really jumped the shark.
And every time you think now is the season finale, no, this was the season finale. So Johnson, let us begin with Johnson. So before he became PM, popular wisdom had him down as a good communicator, socially liberal, a great orator and charming when he wanted to. But also there was a fear that he was an immoral blagger with no interest in detail. It turns out he is indeed an immoral blagger with no interest in detail, but also an awful communicator with autocratic tendencies and about as charming as having your head dipped in concrete.
Yeah, well, that is the best introduction that I could possibly have. You are spot on. My friend, with your analysis. Yes, I mean, that does chime in. I mean, and I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, the three countries at the very top of the list, Britain and America and Brazil, have got these three extraordinary narcissistic charlatans in charge. And I think, you know, he has been found out, I think, in this. I think he's currently, as we speak, what are we now? It's exam season. And he's currently going around Whitehall saying, is there any chance that we could be judged on last year's results? How many corona cases last year? I mean, there were none whatsoever. So I think if we take those into consideration, we could, we can get that average down to something.
We could moderate
with Ofqual's assistance. We can get down to under 25,000. But I think as it is, Alex, I think you're very unfair. very often. As you know, we are world beating. We are world beating. We have a world beating recession. the greatest GDP fall in the developed world. I think we are still the developed world, and indeed the highest per capita fatality. So I think there is still a case for British exceptionalism. Although that has been a main casualty. We were just chatting about this, weren't we? That Boris talks about the great British common sense and that common sense will get us through this. And then the next day you see a headline in The Sun going on Twitter featuring a man who's just shoved 6 cream eggs up his arse. and you think, well, or you look at the sort of scenes on board.
I'm sure he did so with every precaution.
No, yes, indeed. And or you look at Bournemouth. And I mean, Boris likes to think of himself as Churchill. And well, I mean, indeed, but I mean, now do we, when Churchill said, we will fight them on the beaches, I think it is very apparent, if you look at Bournemouth or Brighton, we no longer need the Germans. We are more than capable of fighting ourselves, indeed, on the beaches. And I think it is a great thing. We are still a great country. And people say, as a government, we've been behind the curve. I would say, no, we have been all over the place. We've been all, whether it's been on lockdown or testing or PPE or care homes or school meals or quarantine, far from being absent, we've been all over the place.
What do you think? I mean, it's a strange function of our times that people who we used to think as awful have become heroes of the age. What do you think the more traditional conservatives, you know, the elder statesmen, both on the Eurosceptic side, like William Hague, and the pro-EU camps, like Kenneth Clark, what must they make of it all now?
Well, it's, and even John Major, of course, I mean, who sort of even before this, during the sort of the Brexit time, and Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, who seems to have been redeemed in some way. I mean, I did an interview with him in Dubai a couple of years ago, and I said, do you regret the fact that Iraq means that people just don't listen to you at a time when, you know, arguably, you know, you've got much more to say over Europe and globalization, what's happening now? And he said, he agreed that was the case. And I said, do you think the problems have got bigger or the politicians have got smaller? And he said, well, you know, actually, you know, I can tell you it's a lot harder to do the job than it is, you know, to actually just commentate on it. But I miss these characters. I miss the William Hagues, of course, because, you know, when I was Foreign Secretary, when David Cameron was the Prime Minister, we had a Prime Minister who thought that Somalia was a wine waiter. So I miss them as characters, and I mean, particularly that Labour government that came in 1997. I mean, they were kind of ready formed. We knew who Gordon Brown was, Tony Blair, John Prescott, of course, David Blunkett, Peter Mandelson, of course, Alex, and I still know where you live. Let me tell you that right now. Robin Cook, who was an outstanding Foreign Secretary before he resigned on an issue of principle over the Iraq War. And, you know, you look at the cabinet now, and when you see these coronavirus briefings, they do increasingly look like those task managers that you get on The Apprentice. Just look rather apologetic with the dog's eaten my homework sort of attitude. And you just expect Alan Sugar to say, you haven't got a bloody clue.
I mean, Gavin Williamson especially looks like the local manager of the DFS wandered by accident into the briefing room and someone just shoved a briefing paper in his hand and said, you're on.
Well, totally. I mean, but it's extraordinary how that cabinet purge that Boris Johnson had. I mean, I think there are Conservative ministers who were former ministers of some merit and some quality, you know, and they were swept aside in favour of, you know, because it had to be a Brexit cabinet. And I think it's just, you know, you would expect me to say this, but it's remarkably, if you talk about a cabinet of all the talents, this is the very opposite. And I do think, you know, that you're absolutely right. That Boris, I don't think of him as a leader. I think of him as a cheerleader. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I still have trouble coming to terms with the phrase, you know, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. It's kind of up there with maths teacher Diane Abbott or social worker Jacob Rees-Mogg as being kind of almost oxymoronic. It's not his skill set. His skill set is bluster and bombast and this sort of the demagoguery. And when you're dealing with a pandemic, you know, you look at Angela Merkel, for example, and she is so scientific. You know, she knows He says, if we don't act before it on this now, the figure in October, the R figure will be 1.8. If we wait until November, it will be 1.95. And you think, I mean, the only R factor that Boris is aware of is he personally, because I think I am now the father, Alex, of, is it six or seven? I've got a personal R of six. I think that, and that's the ones we know about. In fact, indeed, Alex, I'm now, we have opened a track and trace system. If you came into contact with me in the last 10 years and maybe pregnant, there is a track and trace form that you can fill in. But your serious point, yeah, it's just not the same skill set. And so your underlying point that sometimes the more boring, prosaic, forensic politicians are more effective. And you look at, as I say, Merkel or Jacinta Ardern in New Zealand. Now, New Zealand is a very different country, of course, granted. But, you know, there's something about, back to John Major, about the decent, quiet man trying to do the best that he can. And he Major himself, was working in almost impossible circumstances.
I think Marina Hyde wrote in a column something that has stuck with me, that Boris Johnson wants to have been prime minister, but he doesn't particularly want to be prime minister.
Beautifully put. Really, really well put. I think Rebecca Front described this, said that we've got a government at the moment that's a bit, it's more like a clown car. And that image, you know, when the curtain opens, yes, and the car comes in with the horns and the wheels falling off, and you know, it would in other circumstances be comic, but I mean, in these particular circumstances, they're particularly tragic. And weirdly, isn't it how extraordinary strengths and weaknesses are interchangeable? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned before about Boris's social liberalism, the sort of libertarian part of that, swap horses, as it were, meant that, you know, he didn't like to tell people what to do, but actually an early lockdown was probably what he needed to tell people to do, and he fought it sort of tooth and nail, because he doesn't like to tell people what to do, because basically maybe he doesn't like the unpopularity. So we locked
down
late, and as a
and their responsibility, because if you actually tell people what to do, then you're responsible for what happens next.
And indeed, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I've been joking, but behind them is that serious point of Boris's character. I mean, Heathcote Williams wrote a brilliant book before he died. Actually, it would have been hard to write it after he died, I suppose. But he died a couple of years ago, called Boris. I think it was The Beast of Brexit, A Study in Depravity. And it's a remarkable handbook as to the kind of character that we were dealing with in Boris. But, you know, they have a similar character over the Atlantic. And, you know, that's been an extraordinary...
Yeah, talking of clown cars,
yes.
The US elections are coming up. I mean, obviously the world would heave a sigh of relief if Trump was ousted. But as an impressionist, is there a little corner of your soul that wishes him to stay? Be honest.
In the corner, there's a suite of rooms in my soul. But we have tremendous numbers. Don't forget, Alex, we have tremendous numbers on the corona. On the corona, we got the highest numbers in the world, over 5 million cases. And, you know, we're doing something right, has to be said. And, you know, because I'm a genius. That's what the J stands for, Donald J. Trump. That's the J stands for genius. So he is, I mean, he is one of the greatest gifts that impressionists have had, and the internet is full of, you know, Trump memes and all the rest of it. But, I mean, back to the underlying reality, I mean, this is somebody who's... It's not uncommon for him to tweet 100 times in 24 hours, which you think, what is he doing, you know, with the rest of his... I often think this, that if the Martians landed tomorrow and said, take me to your leader, in many cases, you'd be so embarrassed. You'd be trying to change the subject, because we ended up with this, you know, an extraordinary. But it has an effect. In America, they have there's a body that studies the poisonings. And in the week or two after Donald Trump suggested, you know, maybe you could inject some kind of, you know, like a disinfectant And then he looked at his medical people and they were looking anywhere but him. You know, wanting the floor to swallow them up. But in the 2 weeks following his suggestion that you should inject yourself with disinfectant, poisonings actually nearly doubled in America. So there is a real effect. I would say that he's washed his hands of the pandemic, but that would be almost too on message as a metaphor. He's not interested. He keeps saying it'll disappear. And when somebody sort of said, well, it will take years, he's, yeah, but I'm right. He did say at one stage, he said, this is an absolute Trump quote. He said, one thing that the pandemic has taught us is that I was right. And there it is. He said, you know, people now, they say, now they agree with me. And that goes for medicine and the rest of it. And you just can't, he's a rather, I often think of him as that, like a cat that turns up at Crofts. and people say, well, hang on, this is, you can't come in. This is a dog show. And he says, so? I'm here now. What are you going to do about it? And the extraordinary thing in both Trump and Boris is that their egregiousness becomes our problem. Because
they turned up at Crofts and won it.
And absolutely, they did. And, you know, behind both, as I say, I mean, I feel that I have to, because my USB is doing voices and comedy, for those who tuning in who didn't know. But there is a serious point behind it, which I think that it's not the skill set. And I still find it extraordinary that across the world you have Trump and you have Boris and you have Erdogan and you have Duterte and you have Bolsonaro and you have Orban. And the seriousness behind this, of course, is what are they? They're all strong demagogue leaders who are busily undermining and dismantling many of those systems like the United Nations and the European Union and NATO that were put in place to undo the damage done by the last generation. Strong men. So I think that's, you know, for all that I'm being facetious, I think I kind of see this thing. And boy, was it Fukuyama who said, you know, had this belief that it was the end of history and that we'd arrived at some kind of benign settlement, as I understand it.
Yeah.
We would have this kind of liberal, democratic, settled position. And boy, has that taken a tumble.
On Brexit, now, you know, you've spent a lifetime observing politicians, so you've got pretty good instincts. What's the feeling in your water? Are we heading for a deal, no deal, paper-thin deal, or an extension?
Well, I think it's what they want. I mean, there is a rumour, I read somewhere the other day, that even Boris Johnson is thinking he wished he'd sent in that other article where he was pro-Remain, because I think you and I thought very similarly the morning after the Brexit vote, when you saw the pictures of Michael Gove and Boris Johnson. They were, you know, you remember the image, it was the producers, wasn't it?
Yes.
They were these two who thought that Springtime for Hitler was going to be the most fantastic
thing. And it turns out a huge success.
So that was, you know, that was actually, yes, that's the end of, that was the season finale of one of my box sets.
I believe the line was, "You ruined my life, you lousy fruit."
Well, so, and I wonder, I mean, I still think at some level that Boris must have thought, but of course the great thing, and people say, oh, well, there were lies on either side, but the thing about it is that, and I don't believe that that was entirely, I think there were more lies on one side than the other, but the thing is that it's only the victor's lies that are going to get found out, isn't it? And I think, you know, but you see that this is the danger. I think, I don't know if you could make a good case for ideology, but ideology has so totally taken over the Conservative Party, this particular Eurosceptic ideology, that I think that they really want, they've got their 80 seat majority. The ideology, so they, I think they want to have, they've got this majority. I think they'd be perfectly happy to have no deal, but again, they haven't really thought out the consequences of that. Where I am on Brexit is I'm a great sport lover, and you and I have sat in meetings where Andy Zaltzman has been obsessed.
Yes.
Watching cricket while we're supposed to be writing comedy, and he's brilliant at both. There is this principle that when the game is held up for some reason, there's a thing called extra time. Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that if we look at the pandemic striking in February, March, and from February, March through to where we are now, it's been pretty impossible to concentrate on Brexit and to negotiations at the same time as deal with a pandemic. So I would say add on extra time. After the end of this year, there should be a period of 6 months extra time to allow negotiations to be taken to take place. I think, I mean, there is a case for saying that actually it probably suits the hard Brexiteers that we are running towards this hard deal, no deal rather, this no deal Brexit. People aren't really looking because our attentions are diverted by the pandemic.
On our sector, the arts and entertainment, or the lovey industry, as the Mail would call it, I vacillate between being quite optimistic and thinking that storytelling is such a basic human need for performer and audience alike that it is irrepressible. But then I see so many venues in trouble and I become terrified that we will reset to a sort of medieval model where we have to start again by doing passion plays in town squares. What's your feeling?
Well, I think you're right in both. I mean, storytelling will, of course, absolutely. Empirically, it is the most powerful thing we have in many cases, you know. But the element that has gone is the audience, is people being together in a closed space, people, crowds gathering. And yes, that's the key of our industry, and the fact that, as people have said, that no two nights in the theatre are the same. You know, you've got this wonderful chemistry between an audience and the performer, and you need your audience. If you say you have a socially distanced audience, you know, that theatre will look, it'll transform the dynamic from a comedian's point of view. It'll be a half full theatre. No matter, even if they're laughing loudly, it will still be a half full theatre. And before the pandemic, we were doing I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, and the theatres had not played in theatres that big for a while. It was 1,800, 2,000 seat theatres, you know, rolling with laughter, and that sound and that energy and that shared humour. And
there's something about the physical huddling together, isn't there? You know,
but also, I was talking to somebody, and this is so, I mean, as far as the theatre thing is concerned, I mean, I live not far from Cirencester, and they've got a wonderful sort of independent theatre there called The Barn. They were gearing up to a very good year coming into next year. They're hoping to, you know, have a turnover of about £1 million. And that, of course, disappeared overnight. But they'd done a lot of preparation. They moved. They did a lot of things online, and they've just done. They're now doing a Barnfest summer festival outside, socially distanced. And you know, they've been very good at. They've been very proactive. So you know, but not all theatres necessarily have been able to do. Not all theatres have outside space in the way that the Barn in Cirencester does. And you know, they're not always. They may not have come out of the blocks as fast. But I was just talking about an hour ago to somebody in the events industry, because, you know, another part of what I do a lot is, you know, the corporates and the award ceremonies conferences. And he told me, this is astonishing, that is an industry that is worth £70 billion to the United Kingdom economy, £70 billion. And if you think, one of the reasons that the economy sort of crashed by to 20% in the last quarter is because we have this extraordinary service-based economy, you know, obviously financial services, but hospitality and events and water and all these things. And not only in this country where it's 70 billion, but also 700,000 people are affected by this. And this is, you know, not the performers. This is the sound engineers. This is the tech, you know, the tech guys, the waiters, you know, the cooks, the chefs. If you imagine something like, you know, imagine Park Lane on a Thursday evening in November, where you've got events at the Hilton, at the Grosvenor House, and you know, hundreds of technicians involved, hundreds of, you know, thousands of waiters, all these people doing, and that's kind of been wiped out. And even though they're trying to do some more hybrid productions where, you know, there might be some on site. I mean, take the Hilton Ballroom, that's about 900 people on a good night. Now they have to cut that down to, instead of 10 to a table, 5 to a table, so they can distance amongst themselves at the table. And then the tables have to be distanced again. So it's like, you know, it's distance squared almost. And you get down a room that should house 900 people with 250 or 300 people. As I say, this isn't special pleading on behalf of, you know, the right of corporate Britain to go and have a great piss up. And although, you know, that, there's an element of that. But it is all our technicians, the people who make that happen. And it is, of course, it's an industry that we're so good at. We export around the world. A lot of the Olympic opening ceremonies around the world and these sort of things and the great events.
Yeah.
The British expertise and technical know-how and, you know, the lighting guys and the sound guys. And we're brilliant at it. And we're suffering from the fact that that is, as people famously said last week when they red lit these theatres and buildings in London. You know, this is almost the first industry to shut down, and it will be the last one.
The last to open. Yeah. On a more personal level, you've been very open about, you know, your ADHD diagnosis as an adult, and also struggling with depression. Occasionally, you've described it, I think, as a black dog, haven't you? That you've trained it to walk beside you rather than jump on top of you. Has the dog been behaving? How has lockdown been for you?
No, by and large, actually, it's been pretty good. I mean, I often think, you know, most people that I know and admire, respect, have their dark moments where, you know, where despair, I think. I mean, I think people talk about depression, but I think that combination of despair and frustration can become overwhelming. But that's, I'm pleased to say that hasn't kind of set in this time. But the ADHD part of it is really, I've once or twice in this interview, I've kind of lost concentration because I followed a particular alley that I was going down and not contradicted myself, I kind of led myself astray and then couldn't get back to the point. That's a very ADHD thing. I was doing a program just to talk specifically about ADHD. I was doing Richard Osman's House of Games the other day. As I got home, really enjoyed it. Really, it was great fun. A great panel of Maisie Adam and James Cracknell, Michelle Gale, and the wonderful Richard Osman. And I realised that mistakes I'd made, which were sort of, there were two or three catastrophic and very embarrassing errors, and they were because I was being impetuous. And the key things about ADHD is, firstly, okay, it affects sort of 1 in 20, they think, but that's a conservative estimate. So 500,000 school children, because it tends to be more prevalent in children. And sometimes, you know, it can alleviate over the years, sometimes it's a life condition that lasts all your life. But the kind of symptoms are irrepressibility, impetuosity, a short attention span, a kind of restlessness, really. But also, with that, also, you do have a hyperfocus, where if there's something that really grabs your attention, you can focus on it so intensely.
Yeah, you can become obsessive, almost.
Absolutely. During a pandemic, I think, yes, I mean, I read on, there's a sort of Attitude magazine, and I read lots of things about how, it's one thing to be where I am in sort of rural Oxfordshire and on my own, but if you have maybe two ADHD children in your family and you're living in a tower block, you know, or an inner city apartment, and, you know, you haven't got the space, but people aren't allowed to leave the house. I mean, that it's a volcanically intense atmosphere, that. And I just say to people who have ADHD, who have experience of it, is that somehow, it's going to sound a bit hippie-ish again, but you have to have boundless and unconditional love and understanding, because if you are constantly beating up on a kid who's yet again he's forgotten his homework, yet again he's not forgotten to do something he's supposed to do, yet again he's been distracted and repeated a mistake that he's been repeated so many times before. If you give him a hard time, or her a hard time, they're doing it themselves already. They're already beating themselves up for, why did I do that again? Why did I make that mistake again? Why have I got myself into this position again? And I talked to somebody about how their daughter had gone through university and had a child and done really well. I said, how did you cope with a child who had ADHD? And he said, you know what? He said, we just loved her. My advice is, if you have ADHD, and there are many, many in our profession, I said to our agent the other day, my agent, how many of your clients do you think have ADHD? And she said, I should think most of them. And you get the genius of people like Ross Noble, the genius of a Ross Noble or a Lee Mack is their incredible speed of thought. And part of that, I'm convinced, is because one of the facets of ADHD is that you don't have that filter. That ADHD, the part of your brain that regulates impulsivity, okay, that stops you from being impetuous, that stops you from blurting out, is in ADHD, in the ADHD brain, that network, that part of the brain is not functioning properly. So you just blurt out, or you are impetuous, or you are impulsive. And for a comedian, you know, a thought comes into your head, boom, out it comes.
Speed
of thought. So there are many advantages. So I just say to people who have ADHD, it will be your best friend and your worst enemy. Your worst enemy, because nobody likes to be disorganized or drop the ball or take on too much. But on the other hand, you know, you have got a brain that will dance around all over the place. And increasingly, this is the kind of practical part of this. I think companies are starting to learn much more about recruiting people who are neurodiverse.
Finally, what are you working on at the moment? What current or future project is firing you up?
Well, I'm part of my brain is sort of slightly furloughed at the moment, but I hear that Spitting Image is coming back. I'm not involved with that. I wonder what it's going to be like. You know, I wonder if it, because Spitting Image, not least of the what made it so good was John Lloyd, the producer, and the intelligence behind it and the writing behind it. And I just wonder if the new version will be, you know, if it will just be out and out rude and scatological and you know, celebrity baiting.
They need to get on the blower to you right away, I think.
If you really want to know what I want to do, Alex, I want to work with you. And there's a number of people, and I think we need to roll our sleeves up. And many of the things we've been talking about, I think we need to roll our sleeves up, and we need to be knocking on doors and saying we need to put a show together which is going to reflect all this, which is going to entertain people, which is going to make them laugh, but which underneath is going to take this on. So I think we need to fight a lot of what's going on with facts, funnily enough.
Yes, I was chatting to Miata Fanbule the other day, and she was saying that what progressive people can do now is we've made huge leaps in understanding, actually, through this crisis, and we need to bank them. We need to be vocal about them, and we need to bank them, because everyone understands now something they didn't understand a year ago, that statutory sick pay and job seekers allowance is not enough to live on, for instance, to give you an example. We need to jump on that, because in 2 years' time that will have been forgotten. And you know, there's a number of things we can do. Rory, you make me forget how miserable I actually am. I wish you and all the people in your head the very best.
Well, thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you. And I mean it. I think, you know, you inspired me when we first met, I think, in the early days of Brexit. And I read your pieces and I thought, this is a man I want to meet and know. And that has just grown. And I think, you know, there are things to be said, and there are things to be addressed, and we have that humour, and we have that curiosity, and the sooner we get into a room together or virtually with a list of others that I have in my head, that is growing.
Avengers assemble. Thank you, Rory. And listeners, remember, there's a new Bunker Daily every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday mornings, with a longer weekly episode featuring a full panel every Wednesday morning. So don't forget to subscribe, review and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And please support us if you can on the funding platform Patreon, where you can search for the Bunker Podcast. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay socially distant, but emotionally available. This is Alex Andreu from The Bunker saying over and out.
Bunker Daily was presented by Alex Andreu. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold. And audio production was by me, Alex Reese. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.